This meeting of the Crime Victims Criminal Records Division will come to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. We have minutes to approve. And Representative Olin moves the minutes from March 5th, 2010, assuming they've been thoroughly reviewed by everyone, and if not everyone, at least Representative Paymar. Representative Olin moves the minutes. All in favor of minutes from March 5th signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Representative Hillstrom, are you prepared? I guess you are. You're right there. You're ready to go.
I'm ready to go.
Representative Hillstrom moves Representative Bigham's House File 3447 that it be recommended to pass and re-referred to House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is Representative Bigham's bill, and so I am going to let her testify and talk about it.
So much. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am David Brown. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney. We have sponsored House File 3447, and what it does is amend the DNA collection statute to fix what we have found to be a gap in the collection of DNA samples. As you all know, this does not seek to expand the kind of people that we are taking samples from. It doesn't expand the pool of people who have to provide it. What it does is allow a mechanism for courts to order it if it's not collected when it was otherwise supposed to be. Right now, we as a state don't criminalize the failure to provide a DNA sample. The way we handle it is when somebody's convicted of a felony, they're supposed to give the sample by court order. If that doesn't happen under the statute, it's supposed to happen in probation, is supposed to collect it. What we've identified, and our DNA expert in our office, Steve Redding, identified was a pool of people. The BCA can't give us an exact number, but it's right around 10 to 20% of offenders who simply don't ever provide that sample. As a result, we're not able to do the kind of cold hit matches that we get. Now, what we've tried to craft here is a mechanism for the courts to do it, and recognizing the fact that the person, the courts should have done it, and the probation department should have done it while they were on supervision, we've provided a mechanism to get a court order first, get a notice out to the person by mail, and only if they don't respond, go out looking for them. If they're given 30 days to provide the sample voluntarily, if not, law enforcement officer can go find them, ask them to provide the sample, and if they won't, bring them before a judge to find out why they won't give the sample. So it's really attempting to fix that once the supervision is expired and they don't give it. The way this happened in Wisconsin was a serial killer who should have given a sample under a very similar statute to ours and did not, and as a result was not apprehended for quite a period of time. And what we're trying to do, oftentimes these bills come to you with a tragedy and a name attached, and what we're really trying to do is tell you we've identified this problem and we're trying to offer you a solution to it before we have that tragedy. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Are there questions by members of the committee for Mr. Brown? Mr. Brown, I have a question just to clarify. Maybe this is something I should know already, but this will be done then not as an action probation violation. Is that correct?
That's correct. This is not a violation. The providing a DNA sample isn't actually part of your criminal sentence. It is a civil remedy, much like predatory offender registration is not actually part of the sentence. So it will not be a basis to revoke somebody's probation. We just want to get the cheek swab.
Thank you, Mr. Brown. Then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion. Oh, is there public testimony on House File 3447 from members of the audience? Seeing none, then Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 3447 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor of said motion signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed say no. Motion passes.
Thank you, members.
Mr. Brown. Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Representative Paymar, are you ready to go on House File 1396.
Yes.
Go ahead and do that. Representative Paymar moves that House File 1396 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Representative Paymar to the bill.
Mr. Chair, members, I have an amendment, and I don't know if you have a 24-hour rule or not. Or
no, Representative Paymar.
Okay. Then you should have the amendment. And I'm going to ask Ms. Richards from Municipal Coalition for Battered Women to explain it. But basically, what this does is the bill does, and some of you have heard testimony on the bill before relative to a victim getting an ex parte order, and it simply adds another relief that the judge can order that would keep the respondent from having contact with a pet or a companion animal possessed by the petitioner. And if I could, I'd like to introduce the amendment to get it in the shape that I'd like to, because there was a little bit of controversy about the possibility of the respondent having inadvertent contact with the pet, and I think that this clarifies some of that. So,
absolutely, Representative Paymar. Representative Paymar moves Amendment A1 in order to get the bill in the shape that the author so desires. All in favor of the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Then to the bill as amendment, Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, maybe Ms. Richards can explain what the amendment actually does, and hopefully it mollifies some of the concerns.
Absolutely. Ms. Richards?
Thank you. I'm Ms. Richards with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. What this amendment does is that the initial bill had language that said no, the court could award no contact with the pet. It removes that language and replaces it instead with if a respondent can be prohibited from taking active steps to harm, conceal, or injure the pet. And so I think there were some concerns about accidental or inadvertent contact potentially leading to a violation of the protective order. What this says is the respondent would have to take some sort of fairly active step, onerous step towards the pet to harm it, to conceal it in some fashion. That's what would be prohibited under the order, and I think it does away with any concerns about inadvertent or accidental contact leading to a violation.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, I have a few testifiers that will be very brief, but I just wanted to say that having worked with abusive men doing direct service for probably 10 years, I'm fully aware of the tactics that a batterer will use to control a wife or a girlfriend. And one of the most difficult things for a victim of domestic violence when they're trying to get out of an abusive relationship is they're always thinking, what's going to happen to my children? And I can tell you, what's going to happen to my pets that become like children? And an abuser knows full well that this is a potential target. So this is just simply adds another relief that the judge can order. Now that's one piece of this bill, but there's also, as you will see, many letters of support I think that you have from Minnesota Veterans, Medical Association, from the University of Minnesota, College of Veterinary Medicine, et cetera, et cetera. So you'll see that this bill has wide support, and I have three quick testifiers.
Go ahead.
Anything else? Okay.
I think our materials are in your packet.
Okay.
Thank you,
Ms. Richards. First one would be Dan Mizielek, probably butchering your name there, but with the Minneapolis Animal Care and Control.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you in support of this bill today. My name is Dan Nijelik. I'm manager of Minneapolis Animal Control for the City of Minneapolis. Prior to that, I served for 8 years on the Minneapolis Police Department as a crime prevention specialist and have previously worked in juvenile corrections. As manager of Minneapolis Animal Care and Control, my job is to ensure that our resources are focused on our top priority, which is public safety. Over the past few years, we have brought more than 500 animals that have posed a threat to the public into compliance with state statute and city ordinance. During this time, working on these cases as well as animal abuse cases and other animals being used in criminal activity, we clearly see the connection between animal abuse and domestic violence. And this year, we started a partnership with the Minneapolis Police Department to provide up to 5 no-cost kenneling days for people who are in a domestic violence situation but are afraid to leave it due to the fear of what's going to happen to their pet. It seems like a small thing, but it's a very important thing. Research shows sometimes that up to almost nearly 50% of some abused individuals will not leave a situation unless they know where their pet is going to go. These are people who are looking at crisis, but a lot of crisis shelters will not accept pets in them. We are looking at our small part, and we expect it to be a small part, but a significant contribution, hopefully, to deal with some of the domestic violence situations out there. In regards to people leaving situations due to pets, I think Katrina taught us a lesson, and in fact, any municipality working on emergency preparedness grant wanting to seek funding must provide a component dealing with the animal portion of it, knowing that people will not leave their houses unless they know their animal is going to be taken care of. So whether it be a domestic violence or a disaster, pets clearly are impacting people's choices and decisions. This bill is important because, once again, it gives people the confidence to get out of violent situations. If we're going to impact the violence in our communities, we need to make sure we're impacting the violence potentially in our homes. This bill is a small thing, but can have a big impact in our communities, and hopefully we can see support for this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Michalik. Are there questions from members of the committee for Mr. Michalik? Seeing none, thank you. Your next testifier, Representative
Pamela. I have someone who has some first-hand experience with this law.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I thank you for this opportunity to tell you a little bit about my experience. My name is Laura Peterson. I wrote things down just so I can stay coherent and concise and efficient with time, so I'm just going to read this. Passage of this bill is important to me for a number of reasons. I don't think people truly realize the risk an abuser poses to their victim's pets. It isn't something that gets a lot of attention, and it's something that a victim of abuse who has experienced this transference of their abuse often doesn't want to talk about, and I know I didn't. When I was a young woman, I was in a physically abusive relationship. Because I lived with my abuser, I didn't make a lot of money. I was estranged from my family. I felt I didn't have many options but to stay where I was. For me, in the midst of something horrible, I just did my best to get by. You know, you try not to rock the boat too much and hope a way to get out will surface. Getting beaten wasn't a systematic occurrence. It really had no pattern. It generally happened if I fussed about not having money for bills or complained when he was out with his friends for days on end or constantly playing video games and wasting our money. So I learned to kind of be single in a way. I stayed out of his way and pretty much did whatever, you know, he did what he wanted, coming and going as he pleased, because it was nice when he wasn't around. When I started to let go and stopped expecting him to become a better person, a better outlook started coming into focus, and I decided to go to community college and work toward a better future. It was at that time that I brought a small, cute, all-black kitten into my home, and I named him Ozzy. I was a little rocker chick at the time. Instead of coming home to no one, I would come home to Ozzy. He was precocious, silly, and cuddly. And when I would lie on my side watching TV, he would position himself on my hip and purr. And things really started when my boyfriend started teasing my cat. He was incessant with his picking and taunting, and Ozzy did not care for him at all. The more Ozzy wanted nothing to do with him and focused on me, the more irritated he became. The teasing turned into rough playing. He would often bolt Ozzy from above his head across the room because he said that cats always land on their feet. I protested and cried, and it appeared he was lightening up on Ozzy. Looking back, though, I remember how irritating it seemed to be to him that Ozzy was all about me. It never occurred to me that Ozzy wasn't safe. Of course, in retrospect, I look back and think, if I wasn't safe, why would I expect that my cat would be safe? It was the beginning of summer, a beautiful day. My boss told me to go ahead and go home for the day, and I was happy to go home. And I opened the front door of our apartment and went in. And I won't ever forget what I saw. My boyfriend was sitting there playing video games, and he had a startled and weird expression on his face when I came in, and I didn't get that until I looked down at his side, and there on top of a trash bag was my cat's lifeless body. I started screaming, and he basically got up, grabbed his keys, and left, and I went and buried my cat. He was 5 months old. I guess if there's anything I would like anyone to take away from this experience of mine, it would be this. If a human being isn't safe from an abuser, what makes us think that an animal is safe from an abuser? They aren't. I thank you for your time and respectfully ask that you support this important piece of legislation.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Peterson.
I have one more. Thank you. Jeannie Moga from the University of Minnesota, Veterinarian, College of Veterinary Medicine.
Please proceed, Ms. Moga.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee. I am very pleased to be able to speak to you very briefly today about this very important bill. The stories, like Laura just shared with the committee, are not rare, and in my position at the University of Minnesota's College of Veterinary Medicine, as the director of the Social Work Services Program at the Veterinary Hospital, I hear these sorts of stories all the time. Women and families bring their animals to our hospital for any number of reasons, but most of the time it's for very significant injuries and behavioral problems, some of which occur non-accidentally. And my job is to work with, assess, and try to help those families regarding all of the human issues that might be leading to those problems. What I'm aware of in my practice is that when people's animals are being harmed by other members of the family, it is very unlikely that they will be willing to leave that unsafe situation if their animals cannot be cared for when they leave. We don't want the threat of harm to an animal to be a barrier to people's safety. And on a much larger scale, we're talking about human crisis on a very individual level here, but on a larger scale, we know that evacuation failure for natural and other disasters is highly linked to pet ownership for people who can't get their pets to go with them. We think that evacuation failure on this very small scale is also very highly linked to not having services for their animals or any protection for the companion animals who are also being threatened. So I would really encourage you to support this legislation so we can remove that barrier to safety.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Moga. Are there questions of members of the committee for Ms. Moga? Questions. Thank you, Ms. Moga. Any final comments on Representative Paymer?
Well, I'm happy to stand for any questions. I think my testifiers have made the point, and I think that this is an important relief for the court to have, and I think that if you pass this legislation and we move it forward, I think that more victims are going to take the opportunity to get a civil order for protection if they need it. And I think they're going to flee an abusive husband or abusive partner more rapidly because they won't fear that their animal or pet will be harmed. And I hope that we've answered some of the questions that were raised by others at the last committee about inadvertent contact with the pet.
Thank you, Representative Paymer. Representative Szymanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Paymer, the language in this bill is permissive for the courts. In other words, it would be at the court's discretion whether or not to add this order for protection.
Representative Paymer.
Ms. Chair, Representative Szymanski, that's correct. The court may grant any of the reliefs, which there's, as you see in the bill, there's probably 10 different reliefs, and anything else that the court might want to order also, but that would exclude, for instance, the respondent from coming to the petitioner's place of employment, or I've seen orders where it even would preclude the respondent from going to a restaurant or a bar where maybe the petitioner might be. So the idea is to keep the respondent away from the petitioner until, you know, the violence has subsided and the parties want to reconcile, or if they don't, to keep the victim safe is the bottom line for these reliefs.
Representative Szymanski.
A little question for me. Representative Paymer, just to help me visualize this. Let's say that the pet is a hunting dog, and you know, it's a pet for both parties, and the respondent you know, has a hunting trip planned, for example, and would like to take the pet on the hunting trip, but an order for protection comes down and says that he can't have contact with his hunting dog. What remedy is there?
Mr. Paymar.
You want to take a stab at it?
Ms. Richards.
Thank you, Chairman. A couple of things. The change here would mean that it wouldn't be a no-contact order. It would be there's two things the court could do. One is award temporary possession of the pet to one party. The other would be to prohibit the respondent from engaging in this list of behaviors, harming, concealing. The way in which this plays out is that if there's some sort of valid reason in which somebody wants the dog, the parties or either the judge is convinced that that's valid, they can fashion an order such. But that would be to the discretion of the judge in each individual case.
And Mr. Chair, I might add, I mean, you know, I don't know if this is going to come up as a request by that many petitioners. You know, we don't have a number on that, but you know, the judge would have to decide. I mean, you know, just like they do with all these reliefs, if they're justified, and clearly at the hearing, the respondent could make a case why they want the dog in their possession, and the judge would have to decide. Representative Olin probably has some experience in some of these cases.
Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask only one question because I'm still a little unclear here. And that question is, okay, the first hearing is ex parte. Is this correct?
Representative Paymar.
Chair, that's correct.
Representative Olin.
That leads to the scenario that I could see happening that is very disturbing. Ex parte order off issued because when somebody knows that there's a hunting trip scheduled tomorrow morning, and WAP, the owner of that dog that wants to take it on a hunting trip can't go near it because he didn't have any notice of the hearing. He gets this order and he hasn't got any chance to respond at all to it.
Thank you, Representative Olin. Ms. Richards.
Chairman. Representative Olin, I'd say two things to that. One is that the ex parte orders are typically 7-day orders, so they're there for a very short period of time. The other thing that we know is 2 years ago, when this bill first came up, we surveyed our member programs, which are located in every county in the state, and asked them about pets and protective orders. And what we heard was that for battered women who are connected up with advocacy programs, that on occasion, they have been going into the court and securing this type of relief under the other provisions, the sort of catch-all provisions. And so these orders have been being issued by the courts, and I haven't heard of the scenario that you're describing having taken place. What this does is really sort of put the relief out there in a way so people who aren't connected with advocacy programs will have the same sort of notice that this is some relief that they could seek from the court.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and actually Ms. Richards just got to one of the questions I had with regard to other protections and if that's being utilized currently. So I assume then from Representative Paymar bringing this bill forward that you would just, if the other protections are being used, you would still just like to see it explicitly outlined, or is it to give more assistance or comfort to the courts in this?
Ms. Richards.
Chairman, Representative. What we found is that then there was some additional sort of surveying done, and what we found is that for battered women who hadn't gotten hooked up with advocacy services, they weren't aware of knowing that they could go in and seek some sort of protection around their pets. And so part of the reason to put it intentionally into the bill is to make sure that even if someone doesn't have linkages up with some sort of assistance, that they will know that if this is an issue, this is something they could certainly approach the court with. And so that's why it's coming forward in this fashion.
Thank you. Representative
Loon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just how I guess from the standpoint of complicating factors, does this, would this be in terms of, you know, if there's children involved in that, I understand you can provide for perhaps some visitation in that. Is this going to bring pets into that realm? And the court's trying to decide, is the issue of the hunting dogs been brought up, kind of whose dog or whose pet it is? And I mean, those are some complicated issues within family dynamics that we may be asking the court to sort out. And maybe they already do that, so I guess I'm asking if this is a big departure or not.
Ms. Richards.
Thank you, Chair. Representative, I would say it's not a big departure. I mean, obviously, there are very complicated factors in these cases on occasion. The court sorts them out right now in fairly short. These are expedited hearings. The court, this bill's been in place almost 30 years. The court has found ways to deal with it. In some ways, it makes it easier to have it in the set-out relief that can be requested as versus having people sort of fashion their own sort of language around this in the other relief categories. I don't think it's a very complicating factor in the scheme of how the order of protection already functions.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm just a little unclear. Representative Paymar, or to the witness, there's nothing right now that prevents a court from doing this, correct? I mean, they can do this if they choose.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Representative Coles.
Chair, I'm not sure. I have concerns about the ex parte process in general. That's a very different process, a very appropriate process, and a necessary process. But I have real concerns about the ex parte process and whether this is an appropriate expansion for the ex parte process, particularly if the court can already do this. I think the issue is maybe a little bit different when we're talking about a more permanent order. But if the court can already do this, I'm just struggling to understand why we need to put this into law. And I've listened very closely to your responses. I just don't know that I'm convinced yet.
And if I may, before you go ahead, Ms. Richards, of course, I ran into the same thing when we were doing the gang injunction statute 2 years ago. And the courts technically could have already done that under nuisance law prohibitions. And part of what this does is to educate the bench. It takes a while for all the judges in Minnesota to come around and understand the available tools they have in their toolbox, and oftentimes when we pass laws up here, it puts the tool on a higher shelf in that toolbox. But I hear and understand your concern. Ms. Richards?
Thank you, Chairman, Representative. I just had one other piece to what I've said, and that I believe that right now that under the ex parte relief portion of the statute that the court would be fairly reluctant to do this because there's very specified relief under the ex parte portion. And the reason that's important is that we know that the time of highest risk is at time of separation, a time of leaving. It's also the reason why if people can't take the pet with them or get relief at that juncture, that's what's causing people to stay or to stay longer than they would have otherwise. And so that's one of the critical pieces and distinctions that I think that this law will also add.
Any further questions of members of the committee for Representative Paymar or any of the testifiers? Representative Szymanski, do you have another question?
Just have one last question, going back to the amendment. Lines 1.6 and 1.12, it talks about without legal justification. Could you just clarify that for me, what might be a legal justification?
Ms. Richards?
Actually, I'm not quite sure why that language got built into this. I'm not sure if it's necessary or not, but this language actually has been used in a couple of other states, and I didn't bring that information with me, but I believe Louisiana was one, and there's a couple others that have used this sort of approach in their protective orders. I believe that there may be some time where there may be, I think it's just trying to say that we don't want to, if there's some legal justification for why somebody has contact, we don't want to try and catch them up, but clearly we want to focus on taking those active steps to injure or harm that are...
Well, Representative Szymanski, if Fluffy is out in the street and cars are bearing down on it, diving in to save the dog would probably be a legal justification in that instance. But Representative Szymanski.
Mr. Chair, I guess the thought came to my mind that perhaps if it were an animal attacking another person or something, that would that be a justification?
I would assume so.
There being no further questions, then Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 1396 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor of, as amended, thank you, as amended. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. Members of the public, we are going to do one more bill prior to the time we get to House File 2960, and that will be House File 3382.
That's perfect.
Welcome to the committee. Chair Lesh, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, I would. Mr. Chair, I move that House File 3382 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight.
Thank you, Representative Lesh.
Thank
proceed
you.
With your testimony.
As to the bill, probably what the best thing I can do, members, is have the expert testify under it, Mark Hossie with the Council on Crime and Justice.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. As Representative Lesh said, I'm Mark Hossie with the Council on Crime and Justice. And we've been working on this bill for over a year now. We started a juvenile records reform working group that consisted of prosecutors, defense bar, juvenile corrections professionals. And the reason we started doing this work is because we often hear from juveniles and juveniles who are now adults and their parents wondering why they can't do this or that, or why their juvenile record is coming back to haunt them when they thought it was private. And there's a general public perception, we believe, that you know the majority of vast majority of juvenile records are private and can't be used for against the juvenile once they move on and become law-abiding. However, that's not the case. There's been many changes in juvenile records law over the years that have made it more easy to access these records. I ask you that, and bear with me, it's going to take a little bit of time to go through the different parts of this bill, but before doing that, I ask that you take into consideration that we're talking about our children here. There's a reason we have a separate juvenile justice system, because we believe that juveniles have to be given extra opportunities for rehabilitation, for reaching their full potential, and becoming law-abiding members of our community.
Mr. Chair, I do have the A1 amendment. If I could ask, I would move that the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it to proceed in.
All right. Chair Lesh moves the A1 amendment. Is there any discussion on the amendment?
As you can see, Mr. Chair, it's pretty much technical language changes.
Hearing no discussion, all in favor of the amendment, A1, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment adopted.
Then, Mr. Chair, to the bill as amended, I'll have Mr. Hossie testify further to it, but not before. I just say we have been, my interest in this lies mostly in the sphere of the fact that, as members are aware, there has been much discussion about expungements and expungement law here at the Capitol over the course of the past few years in light of the growing technology that is making it more available and causing additional collateral issues for people. In this case, though, and I do have mixed feelings about those in some cases, in this case, though, we're talking about juvenile records. We're talking about those instances where you thought the things that you did as a stupid young person would not necessarily haunt you when you got older and wiser to reach the age of majority. So that's why I brought this forward. We do have a letter in your packets from the County Attorneys Association that with the caveats stated about a couple of, or one provision in the bill specifically, we're going to work with them together on this. And with that understanding, they have placed their imprimatur on going ahead and making sure we get this thing through with that exception.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like to suggest, in the essence of time, to ask if there's anybody that opposes this bill, because I don't believe there is, and I think we can get a vote taken rather rapidly on this.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Olin. Is there any further discussion? We have one testifier coming forward.
I'd like to hear a little bit.
No, I know.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Nairn, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Newspaper Association to express concern about one small provision in this bill. On page 3, line 1 through 13, that new language, under current law, there all these court hearings for juveniles who are charged with felony-level crimes are open, and they're open to the public for the reason that adult trials are also open to the public. This bill changes that and says that the judges has to do a balancing test to weigh the collateral consequences to the child versus the public's right to know. We think this language is a little overbroad. We do recognize that there may be some felony-level crimes where this would be an appropriate test, but we have many juvenile, 16 and 17-year-old juveniles who are committing major crimes, murders, sex offenses, and we don't think that those kinds of things should be presumed to not be open as they are under current law. So we do have that concern. We do want to work with the author and the advocates of the bill to see if we can craft some language that will address those concerns, because I do think there could be a compromise on this, but the language as is a little overbroad in our opinion.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the witness? Any other witnesses that would like to testify on the bill?
I don't believe we don't have any more.
Representative Coles, did you have another question?
Well, can the witness in about 2 minutes run through the highlights of this bill before? I'm trying to read it here quickly, and I haven't had an opportunity. I think I'm looking forward to helping Representative Lesh get it out of here today at least and keep the discussion going. But as I'm reading through it here, I see we're making some pretty significant changes. I think I probably agree with them, but can you just quickly run through at least the high-level changes that we're making?
Proceed, Mr. Hess.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Coles. I'll do my best to go quick. There's a lot of working parts here, but Section 1 deals with the issue of human services background studies for people working in nursing homes and certain facilities with children. And currently, there's certain serious crimes and conduct, even if it's not a conviction, can bar somebody now for their life from working in these fields. And what we found is that there's some juveniles who have been charged with something in those categories, and the juvenile records are treated exactly the same as adult in this human services context. Somebody with even a juvenile charge on one of these offenses, if the Department of Human Services finds that they engage in that conduct, even if they weren't convicted, that's a lifetime barrier from working in nursing and these types of things. So what this does simply is gives the Department of Human Services the discretion, based on the factors they have to consider, to give somebody who engaged in this conduct or they found engaged in this type of conduct as a juvenile a set-aside to work after they turn 21. So there's still a check there with the Department of Human Services on that one, and it's only for juvenile records. Sections 2 through 3 is the issue of public court records that you just heard about. Currently, if you're charged with a felony-level offense, it's a 16 or 17-year-old, regardless of the final disposition, it could even be dismissed or reduced to a misdemeanor, that court hearing is public and therefore those records are public. But I have a story on that, but I won't get into it. But basically that involves a lot of juveniles that could be in felonies just don't mean what they used to mean. We've increased them so much that there's some, for example, somebody could steal a bike these days and that could be a felony. And that would, haunt them for the rest of their lives. What this does is it gives the judge discretion to look at, if it's a serious and violent offense, then it should be public, if necessary. And I think, again, I understand the concerns with some of these violent offenses being public. We've tried to tailor it so it does that. We need to give the judges some discretion on this. It's impossible in these cases to draw lines between all the types of crimes, but we're willing to work with the press on that issue. Section 4 is an issue where currently private juvenile records, at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and the courts are not released to third parties with informed consent from the now adult. The statute that governs peace officer law enforcement records doesn't have that provision. So law enforcement agencies can release private juvenile records to third parties with the informed consent of the juvenile. There's a couple issues with this. One is consistency. We did some research this summer. We called about 12 different police agencies throughout the state, and about half of them are releasing these records with informed consent from third parties, and about half aren't. So we're getting different treatment of juveniles in different counties and jurisdictions throughout the state on this. Additionally, we just you know, our position is that we don't want your typical employer to have these records that the legislature has determined are private juvenile records. There have been some concerns expressed on this provision around, can the records be shared with like social service agencies? Can the parent get them? Can the juvenile get their own record without giving it through informed consent? And I run this by data experts at the State Department of Administration, and they assure us that they can be accessed by parents, by certain social service agencies, by the juvenile, the now adult juvenile themselves. Yes?
Excuse me, Mr. Hasse. Representative
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hasse, okay. So if there is, if I'm 16 years old and I'm arrested and there's evidence within the police records that I didn't do it, you know, there's police records saying they dismissed, they're not going to pursue further charges, they let me go, they found out that it was my buddy Jim that stole the bike and not me. And I want to get access to that record because somebody remembers that I was involved in something 3 years ago and I'm looking for a job. I can still go get my own records and share that if I choose to. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, that's what I've been told by the data expert.
Okay. Mr. Hasse, if I may just ask a follow-up question regarding the third party. Let's say the offender somehow his school wanted to find out what was occurring. Would the school administration be able to access those records, and if so, would it be conveyed confidentially?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. The school could still access the record. This does not limit, there's statutory provisions for schools and others to get juvenile records, and this does not limit that. This just limits, you know, non-statutorily allowed third-party release through informed consent.
Thank you, Mr. Hasse. You may proceed.
All right, and I'm on the last sections, which are sections 5 through 11. And what that does is currently the only types of juvenile records that are in the juvenile or in the expungement statute are those that have been certified as adult, which is kind of interesting because those are more serious offenses. But that was done before some of these juvenile records openings were created. There's a separate expungement, one-sentence expungement provision for in the juvenile code that allows judges to seal juvenile records that they deem appropriate or juvenile adjudications. What we found is that some judges are reading that broadly and sealing all the different agency records when a juvenile, you know, shows they merit an expungement or a sealing. And some are following adult law and only sealing the court record. So that record still exists at the BCA or the law enforcement. And what this does is it puts the other juvenile records into the expungement statute 609A, and that has all the same provisions in there around balancing tests for whether the person deserves the expungement, whether they the public safety interest and those things. It includes juvenile records. So the only thing I would like to add outside of the mechanics is that Kate Richtman, who wrote this letter from the County's Attorneys Association, the amendment that you already added is the one that she's proposing. She's also a member of the Governor's Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee, and you've all received this report, I believe. This is a committee of professionals that advise the Governor and the legislature on juvenile issues. And on page 8, you'll see that they're supporting these provisions generally. And I think that's all I have. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Are there any other questions? Are there any other testifiers for or against this bill? Seeing none, no further discussion. Chair Lesh renews his motion that House File Number 3382 be passed and referred to the Committee on Public Safety
as Policy
as amended.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed?
Thank you.
Chair then takes House File 2960 from the table, which had been previously tabled on Friday. That is up. Representative Paymar, did you have any further comments on that? Members, we will not be taking any further. We took all the public testimony on this last week, so we're just going to be moving today. Representative Paymar?
Well, Mr. Chair, yes, we had a lengthy hearing on the bill. I would like, if it would be possible, to at least address. Let me first say that you received a letter from the Legal Community Against Violence, and I think that that clearly refuted at the last hearing some of Mr. Olson's claims about whether this bill was legal or not. And I think that is clear, and I hope that you had a chance to read that. I also think that you have in your packet a document from Protect Minnesota, and
Joan Peters, Joan.
I do think that given the fact that Representative Coles raised some issues about whether this is needed or not, and to show some proof that I would like the opportunity at least to at least challenge some of those assertions, because it's important as you decide whether to vote on this bill or not to know that indeed there is a significant problem, that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms has identified the gun loophole bill as a huge problem, and also the fact that it's difficult to trace where some gun crimes take place from because of some federal legislation. But so the question comes down to is if you want to believe the statistics put out by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or if you want to subscribe to statistics that you're getting from another place. Background checks work. They have stopped literally the 1.6 million gun sales to people who should not get them. That's what this bill is about. Do you want guns to be in the hands, dangerous weapons to be in the hands of dangerous people? And so the question to me is, which seems rather simple, but obviously it's been complicated, is if you go into a sporting goods store and you buy a pistol or an automatic weapon, whatever you choose to buy, you need a Brady background check. That's clear. So why would you not want to have that similar requirement at gun shows? That's all this bill does. And if Ms. Peterson could just...
Insofar as a refutation or rebuttal, I mean, if we do that, I am going to give the other side a few minutes as well. I wanted to get to take this vote. But insofar as that explanation of information, that's okay, Ms. Peterson. Go ahead.
This morning, I need to get closer. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This morning, the Executive Director of Citizens for Safer Minnesota had a phone call with the ATF, information officer. And she talked to him specifically about some of the questions that were raised in the hearing that you heard us talk about on Friday. And he did tell her that the ATF does recommend closing the loophole because they consider it to be a major trafficking alley for criminals and crime guns. And he also said that he could not give her very much information because the TIART amendment has passed through our Congress, the federal law TIART amendment, which does not allow for him to tell her information about how crime guns are traced. And so that has made it very difficult to trace crime guns. And I think that came up, I think Representative Lesh, you even asked that. Is it possible, or maybe Representative Coles, how do these crime guns come directly from gun shows, or do they find their way into the illegal market some other way, and how many times distant from the gun show? And the problem is, because they are sold by unlicensed sellers, there is no record. And so it's very difficult to trace. And because of the TIART amendment, we can't really trace those guns. And so the BATF's hands are tied as far as tracing the guns. But if you've read the information that was sent to you or given to you, plus this report about gun shows, it clearly says that gun shows were associated with 25,862 of 84,128 total traffic firearms connected with prosecutions examined in this report, which does make 30%. And so what we are saying, and I think what we said last week, was that gun shows indeed do provide a mechanism or a way for criminals to get their guns. And I would also like to say one of the things we did not talk about last week, and I didn't get a chance, we only talked about criminals. We didn't talk about domestic abusers, and that's a concern of mine, and I sit on the board of Domestic Abuse Intervention Project in Duluth, and I volunteer at the Family Justice Center, where women come in off the street, and I do an intake, and I do find that many women are threatened with guns. And so we only talked about criminals, but I just wanted to mention that that is a concern as well. We need to broaden that. There are people who get guns aside from criminals who shouldn't have the guns.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. And the intention of this was not to add new information, but if there was a refutation of arguments. So I don't see my old professor, Joe Olson, here, and I don't know if there's anyone else from the other side that wants to give a brief refute. And okay.
I'm standing in for Professor Mr.
You are okay. Why don't you come up here, and it is my intention to take a vote on this within 2 minutes, so you can come on up. And if you can keep it to just simply refutation, not new information.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, basically what we've heard is a lot of hearsay, a lot of supposition.
Please, sir, state your name for the record.
Oh, John Cale, C-A-I-L-E. I'm Communications Director for Concealed Carry Reform Now and the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. I've also been a certified firearms instructor for 40 years, and I operate a nonprofit teaching self-defense handgun training to battered women. So I have a lot of experience with violence, especially amongst the community of battered women. The problem with this whole bill is it won't work. I could go into all sorts of details, but I refute both the ATF numbers. I've talked to members of the ATF. They said that essentially gun shows account for about 0.7%. That is the ATF's actual number of all criminal activities. 99% of criminals get their guns elsewhere, and almost always in illegal transactions out on the street. They have no desire to go to gun shows. I find it interesting that no one in this on the opposition side has availed themselves of a marvelous facility here, the Force Science Institute at Mankato State University. Dr. Bill Lewinsky heads that up. He's well respected by law enforcement nationwide. He did a 5-year study with the FBI and found that of over 800 incidents of shootouts between police and bad guys, they found that 99% of them got their guns off the street. Not a single gun came from a gun show. That's scientifically valid research, not supposition. Okay, so the bottom line is that some of the people asked about what about the mentally ill. Part of the problems were illustrated in the previous testimony on the previous bill. There are many states that suppress that data. You could have somebody move here from Michigan with a violent history of mental illness or potentially violent. It won't turn up on a background check. So our contention is if it had any possibility of success, of course we'd support it, but it doesn't. It will simply create a bureaucracy that won't do a bit of good, because at a gun show or anywhere else, all a couple of people who want to engage in an illegal transaction have to do is walk outside into the parking lot and make the transfer there. Done deal.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Cale.
Thank
that
you,
said, Representative Paymar renews his motion that House File 2960 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor of said motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes.
Division.
Division been called. All in favor of the motion, raise your hand. All opposed, raise your hand. Motion fails. Committee is adjourned.